All right. Amen. Thanks, Daniel. Okay, so we are looking at Matthew 18, 21 to 35, and I will. Oh, hey, Daniel, can you give me permissions to share my screen? I'll pull up.
Try again.
Not quite sure why I picked. Good. Thank you, Daniel. I got it. Why I picked this passage, because it is a tough word. It's a tough word. And I found myself, I think I kind of found myself in the beginning being very challenged. But by the end, yeah, I felt very ministered to by God and very loved by God in the midst of it. So I hope it does the same for everyone else as well. Okay, let me make sure I got the right version here. Okay. Matthew 18. Then Peter came up and said to him, Lord, Peter's talking to Jesus here, Lord, how often will my brother sin against me and I forgive him? As many as seven times? Jesus said to him, I do not say to you seven times, but 77 times. Therefore, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. When he began to settle, one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. And since he could not pay, his master ordered him to be sold with his wife and children and all that he had, and payment to be made. So the servant fell on his knees, imploring him, Have patience with me, and I will pay you everything. And out of pity for him, the master of what of that servant released him and forgave him the debt. But when that same servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants who owed him 100 denarii. And seizing him, he began to choke him, saying, Pay what you owe. So his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him, Have patience with me, and I will pay you. He refused and went and put him in prison until he should pay the debt. When his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed. And they went and reported to their master all that had taken place. And his master summoned him and said to him, You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. And should not you have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you? And in anger, his master delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt. So also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from your heart. So yeah, tough passage. This is in the context actually of Jesus talking with his disciples about being humble, becoming like a child. If you see sin in your life, you should cut it off. Things like that. So there's some different things that the disciples are asking him about, and he's responding with kind of some pretty significant and important words. And this one is right in line with those. Just a little background on the parable. I think I put it here. Yeah. So 10,000 talents. There are some differing opinions on kind of what the specific value of a talent was. But one kind of estimate that I see in lots of different places, it seems widely accepted, is that a talent is approximately 6,000 denarii. And one denarius is approximately a day's wage for a laborer. So somebody who goes out and works in a field, again, we're, the culture in Jesus' day was very gregarian, right? They lots of either livestock and animals or farming, right? And so kind of a laborer that would work on a farm or as a shepherd would receive a denarius or somewhere along that for a day's work. So 10,000 talents is approximately 60 million days' wages, or wages for 164,000 years. So it basically, the point of using that amount of money is that the servant, it's just impossible for the servant to ever pay it back, right? That is, it's not going to happen, right? And then the next sum of money, the 100 denarii that the second servant, the fellow servant, owed, you know, that's 100 days wages, right? Or approximately 3 1/3 months, right? 3 months, 10 days, somewhere in there, worth of work. And that would be obviously payable, right? Somebody could work that off. That's doable. And then the last thing I wanted to point out is towards the end of the parable, he talks about debtor's prison and kind of the sale of the servant to a debtor's prison. So that the point of a debtor's prison was not actually for the master to recoup money. So he would just sell the servant or whoever owed the money and the family to the debtor's prison for just kind of a nominal sum of money. It wouldn't repay what the person owed them, but it was just kind of a way, it was a punitive place to put somebody. And then whether or not they would be able to work in debtor's prison, there's some, I kind of found some references to people being able to work. The kind of sum of money that we're talking about, 10,000 talents, even if they worked the rest of their life in debtor's prison, they wouldn't pay that off. So debtor's prison was really seen as a punitive thing, something that would deter people from falling into debt, right? More than actually a solution for people that fall into debt. So to get into the parable a little bit, as I kind of mentioned, 60 million days wages, it's just kind of a ridiculous sum of money, no matter how you calculate it, right? And even like just the category of that, right? I was trying to think about that in today's terms, and I'm like, well, like Jeff Bezos, you know, who founded Amazon, or people like Oprah Winfrey, right? People on the billionaires list, they have kind of a category for that. But outside of that, like, I don't even have a category for how much money that is, right? Like, that would probably, you know, if I look at the room I'm in, it would probably fill up the room with cash completely, right? I've never seen that amount of money. I don't, like, it just kind of is mind-boggling, right? So I think his point is it's an unpayable debt, and that unpayable debt is with God, right? The master in this parable is God, and that servant has an unpayable debt with God. So there's no way for us to pay God back. And if we, I think some of that idea goes back, if we look back in Genesis, to what Adam and Eve, right? They ate the fruit of the tree that that God had specifically told them not to. You know, you could eat anything in the Garden of Eden. You could eat anything in the Garden of Eden. You had power over animals. The earth was for you, but you couldn't eat out of the one tree. But that's exactly what Adam and Eve did, right? They took what was not theirs. And once they did that, they were not able to give it back, right? By eating of the fruit, they weren't able to give it back. And so they separated themselves from God. And that's kind of what causes our sinful nature, right? And we've now, inherited that sinful nature from them. So we are separated from God, and there's no way to give that back. So we have this unpayable debt, right? We can't earn our way back to God. We can't do anything that puts us in a right relationship with God. So I think this can be difficult for us to handle, to really take in and understand. I think in this parable, right, the servant deserved to be in debtor's prison, right? He had an unpayable debt and he deserved to be in debtor's prison. And so debtor's prison is kind of this idea of taking people out of the world, right? You're no longer able to work and provide for yourself. We're kind of stripped of our rights, so to speak. And kind of, you know, if we think about our nation, we're stripped of our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, right? In God's language, we should be stripped of the right to creation, right? The right to be in creation and have dominion over it. But God, even though that's kind of our situation, and that's what happened after Adam and Eve ate of the fruit, God doesn't leave it that way, right? And in this parable, the master forgives the servant's unpayable debt. God has paid off that unpayable debt for us with the death of his son, Jesus. John 14, verse 6, right, says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me," right? Jesus is the way. Forgiveness through Jesus is the way back to God, and that's how we get there. It's not something we can do. It's something that God has offered us. And that's God's only way, right? That's the way that he created, and there's one way, and that's it. And so I think that initial forgiveness, when we first come to God, when we start to understand who God is in our lives, and we start to kind of get a handle on that debt, right? We start to get a sense for that 60 million days wages, right? And God offers us that forgiveness. It has to do with our redemption. It has to do with our souls, right? And the redemptions of our spirits. The Christmas song, O Holy Night, right, has a lyric that every time I sing it, I kind of get kind of one of those lyrics that gives me chills, right? And it says, "Till he appeared and the soul felt its worth." And I think that's kind of what it's like, right? When we become a Christian, or when we think about our debt, and we start to understand our depravity in that way. And then we look to God and we look to the death of Jesus. It allows our soul to understand its worth, right? Like God actually died for us. He sent his son to die for us. And that, I think that allows me to understand my own worth. We're kind of more than our physical selves. So I don't know if any of you have, if anybody of you have ever seen the musical Les Miserables. I don't know how you say it. Different people pronounce it differently, but it's Miserable. There you go. Thank you, Hepzibah.
You heard it.
Yeah, but it's one of my favorite musicals. And the reason is it actually has to do with the forgiveness and redemption of the main character, Jean Valjean. And if you haven't seen it, I recommend it. And Jean Valjean steals a loaf of bread and he gets put in prison. And in the beginning of the musical, he gets released from prison. And he's walking around looking for work, and he ends up he ends up meeting this bishop, and he goes to the bishop's house, and The bishop takes him in and feeds him dinner and gives him a place to stay for the night, and just kind of cares for him. But in the middle of the night, Jean Valjean wakes up and he takes some of the precious silver that the bishop has. So the candlesticks and whatever else that the bishop owns. And it's a significant amount of money, and he steals it and he runs. Okay. But the next day the police catch him, and the police knew he was staying at the bishop. So they bring him back, right? The police bring him back to the bishop. However, when the police are going and they're bringing him back to the bishop in order to have the bishop say, yes, he stole the candlesticks, he stole all this stuff, so the police want to take him back to prison, right? But the bishop doesn't go that route. I feel like the bishop has a godly, there's something of God in him, and he understands forgiveness. And so what he does, he actually lies to the police and says, actually, Jean Valjean didn't steal my candlesticks. He actually, I actually gave them to him, and he left one behind, and he actually gives him another piece of silver, right? And so he tells the police, you know, thanks for doing this. I appreciate all you did, but he's fine, right? You can release him. So the police go, and the bishop kind of releases him, and Jean Valjean walks away with this big bag of silver. And Jean Valjean's kind of soliloquy at that point, as musicals have, is this. You can kind of read it on the screen, and I'll share it. He's singing this, obviously it's a musical, but he says, one word from him or the bishop, and I'd be back beneath the lash upon the rack. Instead, he offers me my freedom. I feel my shame inside me like a knife. He told me that I have a soul. How does he know? What spirit comes to move my life? Is there another way to go? So this soliloquy by Jean Valjean is very powerful in the musical. It's just it's just a really powerful scene, and it's kind of his understanding of God for the first time. He has kind of this internal revelation of who God is in his life, that God loves him. And I think, you know, initially Jean Valjean is just in shock that this is what the bishop has done for him. But then he starts to understand that the bishop actually valued him, and that he has a soul, right? For the first time, Jean Valjean is actually thinking there's more to him than just his kind of physical being, right? He's got a soul and he has worth, and God loves him. And so I feel like that's the first time where Jean Valjean is kind of set free. Right? He's set free from the world. He's set free from the sin, and the bishop gives him this opportunity to have a new life. And in this kind of new freedom that he has, Jean Valjean, the last line that he says is there another way to go? So in this freedom that Jean Valjean feels, this kind of soul worth, he automatically starts thinking about what he can do differently, right? Who is he? Is there another way to live? It's almost like the bishop is inviting him into another kingdom, right? Another kind of alternate reality that he has, that he can live in. So I think, you know, with this idea that there's this kind of alternate reality, he wants to change and he wants to do something new. And I think that's one of the first points that I want to make. As we, you know, as Christians, as we feel the weight of our sin, whether it's kind of, if we think back to Genesis and we just think about the weight of that, or if we think about just the ways that we fall short in our everyday lives. Either way, we have this sin, but we should have a desire to change that, right? To root out that sin, and to be free from it, right? to change our ways. Our debt or our sin shouldn't be something that we shrink back from. It shouldn't be something that we're afraid of. It should be something that we should really think about and ask God for more forgiveness and ask God to change us, right? To have more heart transformation like Jean Valjean does. We can look at our sin and have a chance to overcome it, have a chance to change. And so sometimes I think when we see sin surface or when we first come to see it in our lives, we can get defensive, right? Whether we're, we don't want to feel bad or acknowledge that that we are a sinner, or that we've done something wrong. Sometimes we have to be self-aware to even know it. In this place, we kind of have to go to God. Sometimes we have to wrestle with it if we don't like it, right? And we're like, no, I'm not sinning, right? We kind of wrestle with it, right? It's kind of Jacob's wrestling with God to before we can kind of submit to him. So sometimes in the middle of a conversation with somebody, and they say something that hurts us, or they say something that gets us angry, or maybe it's just a disagreement, right? We can get defensive, and we don't want to acknowledge our own sin. So one of the things that kind of helps me in thinking about this is just to kind of visualize the blood of Jesus over me, right? Like almost like I'm painted with it. And that God, when God looks at me, he doesn't see me. He sees the blood, right? He sees, he doesn't see my sin. He just sees the fact that I'm forgiven. And so that helps me to be able to, that frees me up to look at my own sin and deal with it, to take it to God, and to look to God for help with it. And it helps me to kind of lay it at the cross, right? Sometimes we talk about dying to the cross, dying on the cross, right? We take our sin and we give it to God. We lay it at the cross. God, we need the sin to be rooted out of our lives. And so thinking about me being covered in the blood and knowing my forgiveness kind of frees me up to be able to do that, right? Because I know that I'm forgiven. So one of the things, I don't know if any of you are claustrophobic, but I'm completely claustrophobic. A few years back, we were in Northern California, and we went into this cavern that's called Moaning Cavern. It's this huge cavern, probably a couple hundred feet wide at its biggest spot. But I couldn't help feeling claustrophobic. I was anxious. I was nervous. I just didn't like being in that cave. It was just uncomfortable, right, at being in there. I knew at any point I could just walk up the stairs and get out of the cave. But there was just something in there that I couldn't deal with it very well. And that's sometimes, if I look at my sin, that's sometimes how I can feel, right? I can feel the weight of it. I can feel anxious. I can feel bad. It can make me feel insecure. It can make me it can kind of have that claustrophobic feeling for me. And so I have to go to God and I have to pray until that breaks, right? Until I know my forgiveness. C740. There's another, I wanted to kind of share a personal example of this. When I was in college, I was a part of a Christian fellowship, and in one of our Bible studies, we'd been talking about forgiveness and even guilt and shame and things like that. And I realized at that point there was something that I had done back when I was in middle school that I hadn't really taken in God's forgiveness for. I hadn't, and because of that, I wasn't actually really able to even forgive myself. And the way that I kind of knew that is sometimes I would just wake up at night kind of, and I would remember it, you know, and I would kind of, it would kind of make me anxious. Or sometimes someone would say something or I would see something and it would just trigger that memory. And that memory would kind of give me this, like, shame would come back up for me, or I would be a little bit overwhelmed by it. And that particular incident happened back in junior high. And it happened, it actually involved a special needs girl that I didn't really know. I just kind of I didn't really know her, but she lived in a neighborhood where I had a paper route, which was the neighborhood kind of next door to me. This was back, you know, in the late 80s when we would still deliver the news, you know, kids on bicycles would deliver the news. And she was around in that neighborhood, right? She'd just be walking around or whatever. And often when I was kind of around and I would see her, she would just make a lot of jokes or try and, she would laugh at me, or I don't know what it was about her, but she just would provoke and she would push my buttons and she would just, I don't know what it was, right? It was just kind of irritating, you know, she was just irritating. And, you know, normally it was whatever, right? I would ride by, or sometimes I would be, there was a little store along the route, and sometimes I would stop and get a bottled water or a Coke or something. And, you know, if she was there, she would just, I don't know, she would poke me physically. Sometimes she would poke me, or I don't know. It was just kind of this weird dynamic. I don't know what it was, but one day, I was in that store buying something, and then I was kind of walking out, and she was overly aggressive. She was really in my face, and she was touching me and poking me and laughing and just saying a bunch of just, I don't know, stupid things, right? And for whatever reason that day, I wasn't doing very well. I don't really remember the context of that day, but I got really mad and I started yelling at her. And she kind of started running away. And so I ran after her and I started yelling at her. And then I ended up kicking her. I was so mad I kicked her. Now I'm pretty sure I didn't hurt her, because after I kicked her, she just kind of walked away. And, you know, she wasn't limping. There was nothing major there, but I just, like, I went back to my bike with the newspapers and I just felt awful, right? It just felt bad. But I was in junior high and I didn't know how to deal with that. I didn't understand God's forgiveness. And I didn't understand that I could go to God and receive that forgiveness. And so I just suppressed it. I tried to ignore it. And that's basically all I did. But then, you know, when I was in this Bible study and for years, you know, from junior high all the way until college, I just kind of didn't really think about it, right? And then I was in this Bible study in college, and we were talking about forgiveness, and we were talking about what it means to be forgiven. And I realized, like, wow, this incident, I feel a lot of shame about. I don't like that I did it. I'm not a violent person. I never have been. But for some reason, I was caught off guard, and she just got under my skin to the point where I did that. And I hated that. I hated that about myself. And so one of the things that I did that is, you know, I obviously prayed during that Bible study and people prayed for me. And then actually the next time I had gone home for break, I actually went back and I knew where the girl lived. And I actually went back to her house and I went up and I knocked on the door. And I wanted to ask for forgiveness. I wanted to tell her parents what I had done and tell them I was sorry. And it was something I shouldn't have done. Probably, you know, it wasn't a wise thing to do looking back on it, to go up and talk to people that I don't know and tell them that I, you know, tried to beat up their daughter. But God used it anyway. And it ended up being that nobody was home that day. I knocked on the door and I don't really remember, but my guess is the house was empty. I kind of felt like they had moved. I don't know if their cars were gone. I don't know what happened, but so I didn't end up talking to them. But I think just it was the idea of facing my sin, right? Of facing the people that I had hurt, going up and talking to them and saying, look, I feel bad about this. I'm sorry. Will you forgive me? I remember walking up the path to their house and knocking on the door, and it felt like the worst 30 seconds of my life, right? It was painful. It was really hard. And so, but, you know, I walked away that day from that house feeling forgiven, right? Knowing that, okay, God, I can't talk to them. There's nothing I can do about this. You have to redeem this. And so I just, at that point, I just gave it to God and I was just released. I was just released.
Amen.
Yeah. And ever since then, you know, yeah. Do I still feel bad that it happened? Yeah, of course. Right. Like I can't, I can't not feel bad about it. Right. But it doesn't have that sense of shame. It doesn't have that sense of undergirding guilt that I felt. And it doesn't shake me like it used to. Right. It's, I know God will redeem it somehow. I don't know how, but something will happen and God will use that for good. So, let's see. Okay. So the next thing I want to kind of go back to the parable really quick. Let's see, 7:40. Actually, it's getting kind of late, so I'm gonna skip that part. So next, I kind of want to talk about forgiving other people, right? When we understand the debt that we have with God, and we're able to kind of accept God's forgiveness. And in one sense, it's the idea of forgiving ourselves for it. Then the next thing is for us to be able to forgive other people. And I think there's a couple things that help us do that. In our Matthew passage, right? We kind of see that when the first servant who received the forgiveness for the 10,000 talent debt goes out and doesn't forgive his fellow servant that only owed him 100 denarii, that the master was angry with him. And so he was not forgiven because he didn't forgive others. So I think there's a way that's very important for us to do, is to be able to forgive others. And I think there's a couple ways we can do that. One is, one has to do with, in some ways, what Sanjeev talked about last week, with kind of God's economy, right? With God, no matter what is happening to us, we can live in God's economy and we can live in God's reality and God's forgiveness. And when we do that, we can live in his protection. We can live in his provision and his abundance, in some ways, regardless of what other people are doing. And so when we look to God, we can get led by him. And when we get led by him, then it's not the circumstances that dictate who we are and how we're doing and what we're able to do, but it's God that dictates that. So I wanted to kind of share something that happened a while ago about God's economy for me. And that was back in 2012. I was actually working for a mortgage bank and was kind of struggling that, and the bank was struggling kind of in the aftermath of the 2008 mortgage crisis. It had been 4 years since, our economy basically crashed into recession. And, you know, at that point, our bank had laid off half, over half of our employees. At that point, we were the eighth largest bank in the nation. We had 12,000 employees, and over half were gone. They were laid off. We had been taken over by the FDIC. We had been sold to a private equity group. And in 2012, 4 years after, through that process, the bank wanted to move a lot of its corporate offices to Texas, to Austin, Texas. And that was, they did that obviously to save money. And that was just, that was in some ways the last straw for folks. By this time, you know, morale with the employees that were left was really low. A lot of them were stressed out. A lot of them were bitter, and they were kind of at the end of their rope. And now they were being asked to move to a different state. So when I was personally asked to move, I was actually offered an all expense paid moving package. They offered me a promotion and a raise to move to Texas and to move my group to Texas.
Wow.
So actually in that moment, it was moving looked like the financial, you know, that was financial stability for me, was to mm-hmm. move and get all those perks. And it certainly, you know, the alternative in my mind was, well, I get unemployment and look for another job, right? And so but as I was praying about it, with my wife, and we felt like God was saying, don't go. Don't take the perks. Don't get tempted by the financial windfall. And we started to kind of really, when we thought about leaving, the idea of leaving our church, VCF, and leaving the relationships that we had built in the church, as well as just with people outside the church and families and relationships that our kids had, we just felt like God was moving in those places in ways that we felt like we couldn't leave, and we didn't feel released to leave. And so we felt like God was saying, you need to stay here no matter what your work does and no matter what happens. So I go in and I tell my boss that. And that was a tough conversation, because I'd come to really, really respect my boss. We had a good working relationship. And so that was just a tough thing, because she was going to move, she was committing to the company, all that, right? So I had that conversation, and she was disappointed, to say the least. However, probably not more than a few days, I think, if I remember right, after that, she came back to me and she actually said, you know what, we're going to let you stay here with your group and we're going to let you work. You're not going to get the promotion. You're not going to get a raise, but you can stay here and work with your group. But the other problem is, I'm going to warn you, you're going to be separated from me physically, from my boss, and from higher level executives. That, and when you separate yourself physically from that, it's difficult to continue to stay in relationship with them and to have them really see you develop. So it's going to be harder for you to move up in the company as time goes on.
No Zoom.
Right. There were times when we were, you know, we would communicate over phone or on conference calls, but she was basically saying, you're shooting yourself in the foot in terms of your career here. But I felt like God was saying, you need to do this, and you need to let whatever happens happen. And so I did. So I stayed there. And everybody else, you know, just about everybody else moved. We had a small group of people, my group and like one or two other small groups stayed. Everybody else in our group at large went. Well, what ended up happening is within a year, our whole servicing portfolio, and that's what I did. I worked in that side of the company. That whole group at large, which was hundreds of employees that worked in that department, that whole portfolio of loans was sold to another company that had the infrastructure to handle the additional loans. And so our whole group got laid off.
Wow.
My whole group did. Everybody in Pasadena was in my group. My boss, my boss's boss, everybody. All 300, however many hundreds of people moved to Austin, Texas, like 8 months before got laid off.
Oh boy.
And so one of the things that I started to realize, right, is, and they just, you know, they were miserable. They were miserable, right? Like they moved to Texas. They moved to a different state to follow this job. And now it got pulled out from underneath them. And boy, I tell you, my employees got bitter. They got mad. They got angry. And those, you know, they felt hopeless. They felt just discarded. All these things came up for these employees, right? And while I felt those things, there was a way that I also felt like I was in God's economy. As you know, at the time, I wouldn't have said God's economy. That's kind of the words that Sanjeev was using, and I'm applying to that situation. And so that at that time, you know, I was sad and I was heartbroken for people, but that didn't turn into hopelessness. It didn't turn into bitterness for me, and it didn't turn into unforgiveness for me. But I just saw my friends, my fellow employees, just kind of spiral down into this space of unforgiveness, and it was bad. It was bad. It was awful. And there was not a whole lot that I could do. But my foundation was in God. And even though I was still being laid off, and I was nervous about that, you know, I was anxious and nervous about that. I wasn't being pushed off my foundation. I wasn't being pushed out of my space with God. So the last thing that I kind of want to draw out with that is when that happens and we start to feel hurt and we have the pain of something, when somebody or something wrongs us, we can get stuck. And we can get trapped by it. We can feel that pain. We can feel the anger. you know, a lot of my coworkers, while they were in that process, they would come to work and just kind of do this mediocre job. You know, people who were just awesome, awesome coworkers. They worked hard every day. When they were at work, they gave it their all, right? And they would just come to work like they were zombies through this process, right? You know, when everything around us and we give into that and we start blaming and we start getting into this, it's a cycle, right? We get angry, we get mad, we get disappointed, and then those things turn into hopelessness and bitterness. And then that feeds our anger and that feeds our bitterness. And it just gets into this cycle. And while, you know, I was angry, right? I was mad that it happened, right? And I was mad and I was disappointed and sad for my coworkers who got left in Texas 8 months after they moved there. I didn't get spiraled down. I didn't get pulled down into that depression and into the things that really create bad habits in us. I didn't get into that emotional trap where we just ruminate in that stuff and it gets bad. And often what happens with that is then we start getting into then addictions, alcoholism, pornography, like that stuff starts to surface for us, right? And we can be tempted by it. And even just, you know, with COVID-19, right? Like, I don't remember what the percentage was, but alcohol sales have skyrocketed in the last 2 months. Why? Because people are at home and they're depressed and they don't have anything to do. And so what do? They get drunk, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to, you know, we have to be careful when we're in that place of losing sight of who God is and losing sight of our foundation and losing sight of what God has for us. So let's, that's all I have for us. Let's move back. I'll stop the share.
How about the two slides?
And what's that?
The two slides.
Oh, those were something that I skipped because it was running long.
Okay. All right.
So I have some questions, Daniel, maybe I can just put them in the chat. And then we can move into small groups.
Yep, sounds good.
Okay. Okay, here we go. So the first small group question is, what do you think about your unpayable debt with God? I'm not sure. I think everybody, well, I'll just, you know, I'm not totally sure about everybody on this call, but I don't know everybody personally. But if you've not given your life to God, what do you think about the idea that God, that kind of God alone is good and that we have this unpayable debt with him, right? And the only way to get to be in a relationship with God is to have that debt forgiven. Question two is God bringing up any sin in your life or mistakes that you've made or things that have happened in the past that you kind of need to engage more, right? Are there ways that you need to go back and address issues that you created, or maybe you've hurt somebody, or maybe you've taken something that's not yours, or maybe you, you know, are there lives that you believe about yourself or somebody else, or about God that kind of impact your relationships and cause divisions or cause conflict with other people that you need to go back and address with them? And then third question is, have you ever been faced with a decision to use? Oh, I'm going to skip that one. Sorry. And then, so the third question is, the kingdom of heaven requires us to forgive others. So is there somebody that you need to forgive, or is there something, right? Like a company, is there, or something has happened to us, right? Is there a way that you need to confront somebody over it and try and reconcile through that? How is your heart towards that person, right? Have you been able to forgive them? I'm going to stick those questions now in the chat.
That's the tough one right there.
Okay, there's the first two, and here is the third. Okay.
Skip number three?
I did skip number three because I skipped some things in my teaching. I didn't realize how long my teaching was because it's after 8 o'clock already. We went straight to question four. Okay. Daniel, you want to split us up into small groups?
Yeah.